I'm going to talk about non-abelian quantum Hall states. Some of you will have seen some of this talk before. I hope you don't mind. But on the other hand, the later part does contain some recent new results. So this is what I'm going to talk about. So first, I'm going to talk about the general ideas of non-abelian quantum Hall phases of matter, or phases of matter that occur in quantum Hall systems. Well, I guess the ideas apply somewhat more generally also. And I'll talk in particular about the relation with conformal field theories and some of our trial states, which are paradigms for phases of matter, but are also closely related to conformal field theories. And then in the third part, I'll go into more detail about the about our earliest non-abelian states and the relation with conformal blocks, and I'll have some recent results, and I'll try to keep you in suspense about what exactly that's going to be. Okay, so first, some generalities about quantum Hall phases, which are sometimes referred to as topological phases. We call them universality classes in our older paper. More that is. So when we have a fully gapped, that is incompressible, quantum Hall liquid state of matter, it's a featureless liquid, it can be characterized really by the properties of its elementary excitations, which we call quasiparticles. And these are basically some quantum numbers for each object, such as the charge of the quasiparticle relative to the background density of the fluid. And also the statistics under exchange of particles, and this exchange has to be done adiabatically. We'll be talking about this a lot. And then, in addition to that, we also have the idea of fusion of particles, where we could bring a particle of type A and of type B close together, and at least from the point of view of an observer far away, or experiments that you could do relatively far away, separation of these two particles, you could just view it as some particle of type C. And these various relationships, all of which are can be viewed as operations on the states of this theory in the presence of these quasiparticles, these operations have to satisfy various consistency conditions, some of which are illustrated here. In particular, for example, the gray group appears here. Grade group. So there's a very rough sketch of a mathematical framework, and the mathematical framework is really called tensor category theory. From our point of view, back in 91, one of our main points was that the use of a rational conformal field theory, two-dimensional massless field theory, provides a rich supply of consistent solutions to these conditions, which in fact were described earlier by Moore and Seidman. So we use a kind of correspondence between a quantum Hall phase and a rational conformal field theory. So the state of the quantum Hall phase with some quasiparticles of types A1, A2, and so on, corresponds to conformal blocks with corresponding fields at positions that are the same as the positions of these quasiparticles. And I have to explain what conformal blocks are. So conformal blocks are the chiral parts of correlation functions in this two-dimensional theory, this rational conformal field theory. So these correlation functions allow a splitting into, in these theories, a finite sum of mod squares of functions in the coordinates, which are basically holomorphic, as long as you avoid singularities at the on the diagonals where any of these various coordinates coincide. And in fact, it turns out that we can restrict our attention to unitary rational equivalent frequencies without
getting too much into what exactly that means.
And so in particular, the grading is given by some unitary matrices in exchange of two particles of types A2 and A3. Corresponding block goes into a linear combination of these same blocks. And this linear combination, so what I mean by the exchange here is that this is just analytic continuation of the functions. And so if we analytically continue until the positions of these particles have been exchanged, this turns out to be a linear combination of the same basis states that we started with. For the fusion, we have corresponding rules which we can write in terms of fields that appear inside the correlator here, which allows us to identify A and types A and B when close together with type C. And then we have the fusion rules, which are the number of times that C appears in the product operation, the multiplicity of C. From the fusion rules, we can calculate the number of conformal blocks that occurs for a given set of particle types, A1 up to AN. So we can repeatedly fuse these together. The intermediate states are able to be. We have to sum over all the possibilities, and then we have to sum over them with these multiplicities so that we get some number of total blocks. And when the number of blocks is larger than one, we will usually get non-abelian statistics. That is, the grading matrices will actually be non-trivial matrices in this space of blocks. So I imagine that 90% of the audience is very familiar with the grids. So let me just go a little further with this, but maybe for people who haven't seen all of it before. Here are some particular quantum Hall states that we introduced in most generality somewhat later. So for example, we can consider bosons, particles whose wave function is symmetric under permutations. And we'll take the particles to be in the lowest Landau level. So the single particle basis states are basically analytic functions which need to be multiplied by this Gaussian factor. This is a basis of normalizable functions at the lowest Landau level. And the Hamiltonian that we consider is this k plus 1 body delta function interaction. So it's only non-zero when k plus 1 of the coordinates are inside. And otherwise, it's translationally invariant. So if we want to find ground states of this Hamiltonian, well, it turns out we can find ground states, since this is a positive Hamiltonian, ground states, maybe zero energy states. If we can find plenty of zero energy states, which are energy eigenstates, just by looking for functions that vanish whenever k plus 1 of these coordinates are equal. And we found, in particular, the ground state wave function here. I won't go into too much detail, I think, about the structure of this. There are some special cases. The KS1 case is this very simple Jastrow product form, which goes back to Laughlin. You can think of this as the square of the Vandermonde determinant. And I'm usually going to omit those Gaussian factors that I have in my wave functions after this one. So this simple product form is the Laughlin wave function in the case of bosons here. And it vanishes whenever any two particles coincide. So that's the KS1 case. And the k equals 2 case is a function that we had in our paper in 91, which is a Kufafian of the matrix of inverses or differences of the coordinates. Kufafian is the anti-symmetrized product of all distinct pairings of the coordinates here. And then we multiply by at least a first power of the same favor Chastra factor so that this is actually polynomial and not diverging. And then the higher order states are
somewhat later, and I won't be leaving them so much in this talk. Okay. Well, we can generalize these functions in various ways, which I think I won't be needing so much here. Now let's come to the connection with the form of your theory. So the nice trial wave functions, it seems, like the ones we were just looking at, which are very nice, actually are conformal blocks of some conformal field. In the case of the Maurice state, these are, you can think of this theory as a combination of a Majorana or fermion field theory, massless fermions. Just take the chiral right moving component of the fermions here. We also use a massless scalar field here, which in fact would simply reproduce the Laughlin wave function of lattice. For the fermions, the use of Wick's theorem and this two-point correlator, which is 1 over z minus z prime, and the anti-symmetry of these fields then reproduces. In the case of a more general Reed-Rezai states, we have to replace the Majorana Fermi field by Pau fermion field. Too much more into details about this. If you want to do the some kind of excited states of any of these theories, you can ignore the one subscripts on this thing. And psi is just our Majorana Fermi field, and we want to insert an additional field called the spin field here, and then look at this chiral correlator, times some suitable Laughlin-Jastrow type of factors that make the wave function non-singular, but actually a polynomial. However, in general, this correlator isn't really terribly well defined, it's not a unique function. Because there are non-trivial number of conformal blocks, a number larger than that. So there's more than one possible function that could appear here. So for this particular theory, the fusion rules are shown here. I'm expecting to see these appearing in a lot of talks this week. In particular, sigma times sigma is the most interesting one. All the others contain a single term on the right-hand side. This one contains two possible outcomes of fusion. So if we have little n of these sigmas, each time we fuse them together, starting with the vacuum, after the first fusion, we just get sigma. And then with two sigmas, we have two possibilities. Then we're back to sigma. Then we have two more possibilities, and so on. So the total number of conformal blocks is 2 to the little n over 2 minus 1. And this is still true in the presence of any number of Majorana fermions. That's what we need for our advanced. So this is the number of those conformal blocks. I'm going to talk a little bit later about the connection of this with paired states. So now let's come to the interesting question of statistics. So the conformal blocks in general, for example, the conformal blocks of the Majorana Fermi theory, have some kind of branch point behavior as functions of the coordinates W. And as we move the W's around by analytically continuing the functions, then we return to some linear combination of the same. So this is the graded operation. But this, however, is done with the coordinate z held fixed. And that's actually not what we need here, physically. What we need to do is we need to adiabatically transport the quasi-holes or spin fields or vortices with W. We need to adiabatically transport them around, as in a very phase calculation. And for that, the basic ingredient is the vector potential or connection as a function of the coordinates W, complex coordinates, which is defined essentially by this. We differentiate the state with respect to one of the W's. We take the inner product with the original state or with any other member of the basis, which I indicated to this, with the indices of the basis, some basis states for the space of the blocks. And the basic idea that we had in our old paper was that if we exchange these quasi-particles adiabatically, we will end up, as I'll explain in a bit more detail, we'll end up with some grading matrices, and these will be the same as the analytic continuation of the functions over the particle space. These look like very different calculations because the adiabatic transport involves for every infinitesimal displacement of W, you have to integrate, take the overlap of these states by integrating over the z's. Whereas in the analytic continuation, you just transport the z's over the w's around, holding the z's fixed. So this was, seems to be widely believed, but it hasn't really been proven in general. Yes. One should think of the adiabatic theorem, which is supposed to hold in the presence of a gap in the spectrum. And then we may have some subspace of states that we regard as essentially degenerate, separated from the rest of the spectrum by a gap. And then in the limit of arbitrarily slow transport, we actually get rid of the Hamiltonian, and we just wind up with some formula like this that basically involves this little subspace. If you want the mathematician's description, as Mark was suggesting about language, then as you know, what we're really dealing with is a vector bundle over a moduli space described by the coordinates W. Coming from the energy of these. So let's get rid of that by assuming that energy is zero, which it actually is for our trial special Hamiltonians. Now there's one or two other things I've glossed over here, but I'm going to come back to this actually in a bit more detail a little bit later. So any other questions at this point? Actually, if you want to also continue being mathematical, this connection is also known as the natural metric connection on this. So here the vector and the fiber over each point in this moduli space is a subspace of the big Hilbert space. All the particle states live in one big Hilbert space, but we're moving around in that as we move them up and so on. So that gives us a finite dimensional vector. So there are simpler cases, including the abelian cases, where this vector bundle is one-dimensional, basic one being the Laughlin states, and that was actually proved a long time ago by direct calculation starting from this. There's also another family of states for which it seems to work under some assumptions, and then try to mention some of the people who have come up with I think really only partial results or results that depend on some assumptions, maybe natural, but maybe not compelling assumptions. And that certainly supports this conjecture. All right, so I want to look at our trial wave functions in a bit more detail now. So here's the ground state case, this is written out the Pfaffian of 1 over Zi minus Zj. I nearly forgot to put the alternating sign in here. This is the sign of the permutation, of the n particles. And this is basically anti-symmetrizing of all the ways to divide the particles into distinct pairs. And then it's multiplied by, in general, some power to n power of this Lofgren-Castro event. Earlier I put that equal to 1, but we can do more general.
And then we have the functions for two quasi holes.
Little n equals 2. And in fact, you can basically get these by inserting an additional factor inside the Pfaffian, which is notation. So this makes the function vanish if one member of a pair is equal to the coordinate W1, although it's not 0 if the other coordinate is equal to the same W. And in fact, these functions, as I've asserted, I think already, if you put little n is 1 here, you can actually convince yourself this function vanishes when three coordinates are equal. So that's because with the first power there, this factor vanishes when any two are equal, but we divide out, sometimes we divide that out, so it doesn't necessarily vanish when two coordinates are equal. But if the third one is equal, there's no way for that to be divided out by this packet, so it actually vanishes. In the case with the quasi-holes, the function actually vanishes if any two coordinates are equal to one of these W.
And that's not an accident, that's part of the structure of the underlying conformals. Okay. If you want to go to more than two quasi-holes, you can certainly try to generalize in the same fashion by taking a Pfaffian of something which is again 1 over Zi minus Zj. But it turns out that now you have more than one choice for what function you put here. You really have a space of functions inside the Pfaffian. And this turns out to correspond to the space of conformal blocks. So all of these functions are in fact conformal blocks. Yes? Okay, that's a good question. Yeah. So here I've included, in this case, I've included here a power of the W's. If I just want to call a wave function for the particles, there's no real need to put that factor in. I could certainly leave it out. It had nothing to do with the Z's. By putting this factor in, this actually makes it a conformal block of the combined Majorana Fermi and scalar theory. The 1 over 4m, as you know, is coming from the abelian Laughlin factor part of the theory. And the minus 1/8 is part of the Majorana Fermi theory. That's the conformal weight of the spin field sigma is 1/16. That's why the factor is. Here I've just stuck it in, but we can say something more interesting about it. So I'm going to try to analyze these functions a bit more today, and let's do that by considering pairing. So we're going to make use of BCS theory as applied to spinless fermions in 2 plus 1 dimensions. What are these fermions? In our context, these fermions are composite fermions. They really represent the underlying particles, such as electrons, one of these bound to m vortices in the total wave function. Think of that parenthetically, since I'm not going to explain anything further than that. So that relates it to quantum Hall systems. If I want to, I can ignore the those Laughlin factor parts of the wave function, and I can think of my conformal blocks of the Majorana theory itself
as related to just starting with a problem of pairing of fermions that we're going to describe now. And the results apply to such a paired superfluid. So it's called, referred to as a PX plus IPY. So the way this is handled within the BCS mean field type of approximation is by replacing some underlying Hamiltonian which contains kinetic energy for the particles and interactions between particles. Replacing that at a mean field level by a purely quadratic Hamiltonian that is quadratic in these field operators CK, which are made canonical anti-commutation conditions. So here, psi k is just the kinetic energy of these fermions. And delta k is something which has p-wave symmetry. It transforms as angular momentum 1 in a two-dimensional sense under rotations in k-space. And not only that, but also as k goes to 0, it's simply of the form kx minus I ky times some constant. So let's take this and try to solve this problem. Since it's quadratic, we ought to be able to do that. So it turns out the wave function, as discovered by BCS, can be written in this form. Actually, I've changed it a bit from BCS, but it's equivalent to the usual BCS. It's an exponential of something quadratic in the creation. Well, one way is that it's not normalized, and the other is I wrote it as an exponential, which I think Schrieffer probably wrote it that way first, and then realized that, you know, when you expand this exponential, each terms of order higher than one in each CK dagger, C minus K dagger, vanish because of thermal statistics. But this is more convenient. So how do we solve that? Well, we need to diagonalize this Hamiltonian. We can do that using a Bogoliubov transformation. We take, find a new alpha k with canonical anti-commutation relations to be a linear combination of ck and c minus k dagger. And these are supposed to be destruction operators, so they are going to be defined to annihilate this ground state and also to diagonalize the Hamiltonian that we had a moment ago. So those are the conditions. So if we now, obviously, will define the U's and V's. So by demanding that this is diagonal, we're led to some equations for U and V, which we can think of as Bogoliubov Degen equation written in k-space. So we can use plane waves here, since at this stage things are translationally invariant. And then it turns out that GK is just VK over UK. Then there's an important distinction of cases that occurs. In fact, there's a phase transition that occurs at mu equals zero. Mu is the chemical potential, which appears in the kinetic energy. In fact, we can basically think of the kinetic energy psi k as nothing but minus mu. And so the difference is that when mu is positive, gk has a singularity as k goes to zero that behaves like this. Whereas when mu is negative, it's gk is analytic. I refer to these as weak pairing and strong pairing, respectively, because the weak pairing case is the case with mu nice and positive. This would correspond to recoupling. Did I say k smaller? K goes to zero. So in the limit as k goes to zero, this is the leading asymptote. There is actually a closing of the spectral gap at the point when mu is zero. And this behavior is, we may need k smaller than mu here.
actually, I don't think we should really apply K less than mu. But there's some other microscopic scales around which I've just neglected, some other higher energy elements and scales which are like some kind of cut. Okay, so given one of those BCS wave functions states, we can calculate its wave function, which is defined in this way, and lo and behold, in position space here, this is nothing but a Pfaffian of a matrix, which is a function of the coordinate Zi and Zj, in fact, the difference of them in this case, and this is just the inverse Fourier transform of Gk. And because of the singularity of Gk as k goes to zero in the weak pairing phase, which I'm going to concentrate on, this goes as 1 over Zi minus Zj. So in this phase, the long distance behavior of the actual wave functions agrees with that of our trial states.
So this is an indication that we have some connection between these different things. Let's see what else we can do with this.
Well, one thing we can do is we can take the Ogier-Bontijen equation and transform it back into position space, and we'll look at long wavelengths, small k again. And in that limit, because of the limits of delta k and psi k, this actually becomes this equation here, which is just a version of the Dirac equation. Involving this two-component object, u and v. And if I write it in terms of position and time, this equation, as you can very easily check, is compatible with a condition that u equals v star. It's a property of this. In particular, if I take the complex conjugate, then I find that it maps back onto itself.
So this is a Majorana condition, and it arises in this case really from the fact that the equations for the field operators have psi and psi dagger in the two components, which are supposed to be adjoints of each other, so we need a condition like this to be satisfied. So suppose we want to take this analysis, basing it on this Dirac equation, and now go on to the vortices.
So to do this, what we want to do, the vortex is going to be something with a magnetic flux quantum, a half quantum of magnetic flux, as in usual BCS superconductors. And we're going to consider this in the rather simple limit where the penetration depth is zero, so the flux is just a delta function of u. And also the coherence length is zero, so there's no effect on the pairing outside of this length. And so in that case, the only role of this vortex, if we put it at the origin, let's say, the only effect it has is that my spinner, well, by a choice of gauge, again, for this bundle this time, by a choice of gauge, I can just think of this as nothing but a anti-periodic boundary condition as I go around the origin. Okay, so it goes back to itself times minus one. And in this gauge, then, the Dirac equation, equation is actually the same equation as before, just have functions with an extra boundary condition. So then you can ask, is there a zero mode, that is a zero energy bound state in the spectrum of this problem with just one vortex at the origin?
And until recently, I didn't know how to describe this in terms of the Dirac equation language without getting into some more microscopic assumptions that I used in the previous paper.
But it turns out there's a nice way to understand what happens here using the Dirac equation. And the point is one has to be careful about the self-adjointness of the Dirac operator in this problem. And it turns out that if you look at this problem more generally for the Dirac equation with some flux, which is described by a real number modulo 2 pi, there's a phase change like this, generalized to be an arbitrary phase. It turns out there's also not only a one parameter family of fluxes, there's also a one parameter family of distinct boundary conditions you're allowed to use to make it self-adjoint. It's very important to have a self-adjoint problem to make it physically well-defined, and a guy called D'Souza Gerbert studied this in the late
Now, what we want to do is combine this with the Majorana condition.
And first thing you notice with the Majorana is that the flux is actually forced by the Majorana condition to be either 0 or pi. Those are the only allowed values of flux. And then you also notice that when you look at these boundary conditions, only two of those survive as well. There are two possible boundary conditions. If we take the, obviously the phi is 0 case, it's not very interesting. So if we take the phi equals pi case, modulo 2 pi, there are two distinct boundary conditions which are defined by the allowed behavior of the spinner as little r gets to 0 really important. And these are, you have to look rather closely at these, because it involves a relation between the two components of the spinner. And the only difference between these is the sign. Now this allows an inverse square root behavior at the origin. This function chi, well, it could actually be 0, that would be quite acceptable. It could go to 0 and limit, that's fine. Then you can have anything you want. If it's not going to 0, then chi, which is itself anti-periodic, then you get a boundary condition. You get some required behavior on those functions. And then it turns out that for each of these two possible boundary conditions, there exists a zero mode, but only on one side of the transition. So one boundary condition gives a zero mode on one side of the transition, the other one gives a zero mode only on the other side of the transition. Now, in fact, this was behavior that we had deduced from looking at more microscopic models and so on, some studies in about 2000. Now we actually see this coming out of analyzing. In the context of the superconductor, only one of these types of vortices actually shows up, and so we can say that the new positive case corresponds to whichever of these two boundary conditions is the one that gives us a zero mode.
What's the criteria that fits into the boundary condition?
Well, it's which side of the transition you're on, but I haven't really, somehow there's some microscopics, something more microscopic is picking out which one you actually have. And that has to do with, you can also, more microscopically, you can also look at the full topology of the case bits, going all the way out to case, bits, and that kind of stuff. But actually, I don't know the very details of that. Yeah, you can make that sort of phase choice, which is sort of not quite what I've, that is what I've, yeah, that's more, that's what I've,
not exactly what I did.
In fact, I'm not even sure that, to be honest, I think this may not satisfy the Majorana condition, but it doesn't matter. Yeah, but I'm in the continuum limit where I'm bigger than the length scale that he mentioned. The limit where I can linearize the spectrum and get the Dirac equation. Or it would be linear if it was at the critical point. So there's a mass scale which is set by mu, and that length scale is much bigger than any other microscopic length.
If you make the Dirac equation, that give you these two solutions that you just mentioned? One for mu larger than zero.
Well, this is not a solution, this is just boundary conditions.
Yeah, okay.
And this is the behavior of the bound state when it's, you know, when it's normalizing.
So I guess my feedback on the question again, how does the other one disappear? The one that is smaller than zero?
Well, you have to impose a boundary condition. You can't just consider all boundary conditions willy-nilly. You have to impose that in this case of functions.
Okay, and you say that you can.
So you're forced to make a choice, either this one or this one, either this boundary condition or this boundary condition. And this is, if you like, is a choice of a type for the vortex. So there are two types of vortex for the Dirac equation. You have to pick one.
And for the superconductor,
and some underlying, more microscopic aspects of the physics, picks that it gives you only one type and not the other type. As we all know. If you look at the Schrock equivalent network model, people don't know what that is, you can actually get either type of vortex just by pushing the flux on either of the two sublattices. You actually get both cases. And this would then presumably must arise as the merge, as the continual limit of the vortex of the Schrock equivalent. So that's one thing that we understood. I want to get to something else. Okay, so now we want to look at a case with many vortices, or these little n vortices for some finite n. And we want to look at many particle wave functions with big n particles. So at least a little bit schematically, what we can do is we need to solve the Bogle-Yubov-Nishan equation seen in the presence now of the vortices, and then we can use that to construct the ground state, okay, which is not normalized. And it has the same general form written in position space. We have an anti-symmetric matrix M here, and M is basically the Green's function for the massless Majorana Dirac equation with vortices at these points. So at each of these points we have vortices with the boundary conditions. And as Zi goes to Zj, this goes to a constant over Zi minus Zj.
As it did before. Okay. So now we come back to the issue of non-abelian statistics.
So in general, what we're going to have is a set of states alpha, and the distinct states that I'm talking about will be obtained by taking the ground state, that's one state, and then we can create fermions in zero modes. The zero modes are shared in this problem. One distinct mode is shared between two vortices. So the maximum number of fermions that can occupy these zero modes is some little n. So that gives us some number of states. Anyway, let's think about it a little bit more generally here. Suppose we have a set of states like this, and then suppose we're all further normalized. So then, really, for the adiabatic transport, I have to look at this matrix values connection on this moduli space, the space of values of the coordinates. So this is the Berry connection, so kind of matrix values, vector potential, kind of like an UN. Calculate the gauge invariant effect of exchanging two quasi particles, we need to integrate under adiabatic transport. We need to integrate, exponentiate and integrate this connection. So we have an exponential of a line integral, but since A is a matrix, this has to be a half order exponential. And furthermore, because the states may be multi-sheeted functions of the Ws, as in the simple case of Z minus W to a fractional power, when you come back to your exchanged positions, you have to transform back to your original basis. So there's a further matrix straight B here, in addition to the Berry connection part here. So there are these two ingredients, and by combining these two, the result of transport is gauge invariant. So to summarize that, then the grading that we're looking for on curly B, say, is this product of matrices. And then there's a further important fact. Suppose the psi alphas, of which I said are all for the normal, suppose they're also holomorphic functions of the Ws. Okay? D by dW bar of one of these is zero for all I and all alpha. Okay? Then what happens is that I can, in the Berry connection, I can pull the d by dw outside the inner product. It's just the d by dw of the inner product. So if I make the simplest assumption that g alpha beta is constant, or in fact a vertical delta, then the Berry connection is just zero. So this is what happens in the simple abelian examples that were understood in the 80s. And it was idea that this is what happens also in the non-abelian cases. That is, what this means then is that the Berry connection term is zero, and the effect of the result of adiabatic transport can be read off just by looking at the basis change matrix for the states themselves. And this is the same matrix that you get from the analytic continuation of the function by definition. Which one?
Well,
curly or straight?
Straight view with two lines.
Yeah, that's the two lines under it means it's a matrix, and it's defined by obviously chosen the basis for our conformal blocks, basic conformal blocks. When we analytically continue, we get a matrix, a Bayesian matrix, expressed in terms of that basis. Yes, as grading viewed as analytic continuation. Well, it may or may not be there. Okay, we said we had some bunch of functions depending on W's, but these, because we've got a punctured space, we take the W's around each other, these basis states may not come back to the same basis states. Okay, when we it's about one or the other.
I mean, maybe another way of saying is that it's only that combination of the product, which is
gauging variance.
Gauging variance, yeah. Like, depending on how you normalize the waveform,
you can
check
it. You can shift it from one piece to the other. That's exactly. Yeah. So what I'm making the observation, which is a key observation, that if our functions are not only orthonormal but also depend holomorphically on these W's, then this part drops out. Then we would just conclude that these are equal. So. Right. Yeah, it is a flat connection. Yeah, it's flat.
It's already a choice we can make.
That would have been easier if I decided to. Well, that's what this is. Well, because that's in a general basis, that's what you get. Okay. And this is the point you have to understand to continue with the calculation. Okay. All right. And then I also want to point out that in conformal field theory, there's also an inner product, which I call straight G. And this is associated with the conformal blocks. Where does it show up? It shows up when we have a correlation function. This would be the kind of one we've got here in the Ising model. And we have to combine the conformal block functions in the right and left coordinates. And so in general, it could have this form. And so we need a matrix G alpha beta, which is some kind of inner product on the space of on the vector bundle. Moduli space. And in typical theories like the ones we're looking at, we use a diagonal theory where, in fact, this just boils down to a Kronecker delta as well. And so what's so this is leading up to the following statement, which is that all we really need to show what we need to show is that the is that the wave functions of our states are the conformal blocks. And all we need to show is that the inner product of states defined by integrating over coordinates, which is a matrix curly G alpha beta, is the same as the matrix G alpha beta, which appears in the conformal field. And it's very important that this matrix is independent of all of these of the coordinates W. I mean, there's a choice of basis there as well, but this is the basis independent statement. Okay, so if we can show this, then the adiabatic statistics does agree with analytic continuation. Okay. So Nyack and Wilczek in 96
actually constructed the conformal blocks for n particles or Majorana fermions at little n's four quasi-holes. And here they are. So basically, here are the Pfaffians. Here's the more complicated function I didn't write before, divided by zi minus cj. It's a function somewhat like the one in the two quasi-hole case, with differences of z's and the various coordinates w. And we've got a Pfaffian of this guy, so that's a recognizable object. And then we also have some other factors, as we did in the two quasi-hole case, which are functions of w's only. And in fact, we've made a particular choice here, alpha, which we'll label by 0 and 1 half, as big values, corresponds to a choice of plus minus sign for an alpha stick here. And those are the particularly nice combinations. X is the cross ratio. And so basically, in one of these, like H1, 3, 2, 4, 1 and 3 are treated on one footing with the first coordinate, Zi here, with a vanishing positive 1 half power here, and alpha, alpha, beta, and negative power for the second coordinate, and the reverse for the other two. So the function involves distinguishing the four quasi-holes into the two pairs.
So what Chaitan did was he used the technique from an old paper, really old paper, 30 years old now, by Hitzitz and Zubé, of doubling the Majorana field theory. So that's using the basic idea that a complex Dirac Fermi quantum field theory is equivalent to two Majorana quantum field theories. And by taking real and imaginary components of a complex Dirac Fermi. And then he was able to actually extract these functions. Okay. And an important point to notice here is why did we prefer this basis? Well, this basis is the one where the blocks, where the correlation function is in this diagonal form. So a matrix G is just a Kronecker delta. So I'm going to use some similar technology. I'm going to consider a double theory, but in a slightly different way than they did. I'm going to double the whole thing. So I'm going to have two kinds of particles, as well as my spin fields. And actually, you can think of this, if you're a quantum Hall person, you can think of this as a bilayer state, a 3-3-1 state. You can also think of it as a pair state for a two-component composite fermions, which we can label by up and down, pseudo spin, or something like that. And in this theory, the vortices carry a sign choice either plus or minus. So we can think of 1 and 2 as plus and 3 and 4 as minus. And then the BCS ground state for this problem has this form here. You just calculate it out. And you see it's got very much the same type of factor in it as Chaitan's own functions. So this is the starting point. Now here, the two n particles, let's say, so the zi's are the up particles, and zi prime are the down particles. The wave function of this is a determinant where the rows are the up particles and the columns are the down particles. But this determinant can be written in a bosonized form, if you like. You can extract these factors, complicated factors here, all the way outside the determinants, and then just use the Cauchy determinant identity, and so you can actually write this whole thing down in a product form, which Coulomb gas form. Okay, so we've got a Coulomb gas in which the up particles have charge plus one, down or primes have charge minus one, and the up vortices have charge plus a half, the down vortices have charge minus a half. Left out some factors involved in W. If it was really a Coulomb gas, there would be some similar factors involved, differences of W's. So now I'm actually on my last slide. So this theory, this Coulomb gas theory, is abelian.
There's really only one block. Once we specify the plus or minus signs for all the particles and the vortices. However, we can also think of the signs of the vortices as something at our disposal. And then, since if you want to, the simplest thing to look at actually is to have equal numbers of plus or minus particles, and then we should have equal numbers of plus or minus vortices. So that gives us 4 choose 2, which is 6 different functions. But actually, they're not really different functions, because you can, there's an overall symmetry of plus and minus. Interchanging the plus and minus vortices and simultaneously the up and down particles. And so that leaves you just with 3 distinct functions.
It's cool, I guess. And it turns out that you can easily show that these functions are orthogonal. I may have probably left out an estimate, but also left out some of the W dependence. But if I take the functions that are the actual conformal blocks of this complex Dirac fermion field, which are just Coulomb gas functions, they're actually orthonormal. In particular, if I take the self overlap, then I get something which is independent of the positions of the W, as long as they're not separate. If I take an off-diagonal overlap, it actually falls exponentially in distance. Now that, in that case, it's not quite an ordinary Coulomb gas partition function. It contains a complex factor in it. But you can handle that if you think about mapping to sine coordinate fields. You can understand that this thing must be called an exponential cluster. Now the length scale that I've omitted here is an order of particle spacing.
Same exponential as in some properties involving the zero cross.
Okay, so now we can analyze this using going to a Majorana long spinless point of view by taking, say, psi up dagger as psi 1 dagger plus I psi 2 dagger, similarly for psi down. So we can think of these are like in the double layer quantum rule system. And then you can analyze these 3 different functions as combinations of these 2 blocks for spinless particles, and that is the product of the function, one of these functions for the 1-type particles and another one for the 2-type particles. And indeed you find that you can exactly do that. It just works without any extra functions of W.
It's important that that works.
That was the longest part of the calculation. Might have been quicker if I'd been using Mathematica for some time. And the consequence is
that that you can deduce that the overlaps of the Majorana conformal blocks here are also just the Kronecker delta in the same basis. So this curly G is equal to that's the end of the calculation. So that means that the adiabatic grading of these blocks is the same as the analytic continuation grading. And, the only assumptions that went into this were rather simple and straightforward assumptions about the behavior of this Coulomb gas, that the Coulomb gas is an extreme phase. That's really all you need to make the calculation. So the only assumptions that enter are extremely natural and simple. Very much like the Durobus frequency calculation.
Okay, so it took a long time, but finally we have proof of this important fact. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.